versus Hatton-Lubick. Mr. Beals.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, my name is Bart Beals, and I'm here on behalf of appellant Michael Hatton-Lubick. Your Honors, I would like to start my argument with my client's due process rights. His due process rights were violated when the district court did not give explicit reasons for why the drug amounts were used in sentencing my client. Now, this court has ruled that at sentencing, a district court must make explicit reason findings on the quantity of drugs attributable to a defendant as relevant conduct and base those findings on reliable evidence. Well, when my client was sentenced in November of last year, my client, the court did not give a reason why the drug range of 5 to 15 kilograms of cocaine was attributed to my client. Instead, the court did make a remark that the court did state that those issues were addressed in the court's findings of facts when my client was found guilty after a bench trial. However, in looking at the findings of fact by the court that was rendered upon finding my client guilty after a bench trial, what was at issue at the trial was whether or not my client was a part of a conspiracy. Although the trial counsel, my client did not contest the issue of whether or not he possessed with intent to distribute amounts of cocaine, the real issue is whether or not my client was a part of a conspiracy, in which the court ruled that he was. The court also made several other, in ruling that he was, in making that determination on that he was, the court made ruled several other facts, including that my client was involved in approximately 12 transactions. And the court did also discuss drug transactions on two separate occasions, on June 25, 2003, and I do believe July 16th of 2003.
Why aren't those findings taken all together in the aggregate enough to sustain the drug quantity at sentencing? Why did the judge, since this was a bench trial, have to repeat herself?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the significance is my client was attributed with having between 5 and 15 kilograms of cocaine. Even if you took the court's findings, in fact, from the actual bench trial, as I mentioned before, the court mentioned two transactions, one in July of 2003 and one in June 2003 and one in July of 2003. Each transaction she did mention that involved a kilogram of cocaine. And then the court also mentioned that there were approximately 12 transactions, and the amounts, the weights given was between a quarter of a kilogram to a kilogram. And since the court didn't give anything beyond that, even if you took those findings of fact, then that would mean that at two transactions, a kilogram apiece would be 2 kilograms. And the rest of the transactions, since 12 transactions were ruled that this occurred by the court, then that would leave 10 more transactions. And if you take it at a quarter of a kilogram apiece, that would be 2.5 kilograms of cocaine. In aggregate, that would make it 4.5 kilograms of cocaine, which would make it a different, I do believe it makes a different sentencing mechanism, because once 5 to 15 kilograms of cocaine was attributed to my client, instead of being subject to a statutory minimum of 5 years, he was then subject to a statutory minimum of 10 years. If you look at the court's findings of fact from the actual trial, that would potentially put my client as being attributable to 4.5 kilograms of cocaine, which, I do ask the court's indulgence, I don't have the sentencing guidelines before me, but I do believe that would not subject him to the statutory minimum 10 years as opposed to statutory minimum of 5 years. And it would also significantly affect his sentencing guideline range in the actual sentencing process. So for that reason, Your Honor, I don't believe that those findings of fact from the actual trial, the bench trial, would still satisfy the explicit reasons, because there's the court didn't give, there was never any findings of fact that said, well, this amount of drugs are attributed to Mr. Haddon-Lubbock, and these are the reasons why they're attributed. And if Mr. Haddon-Lubbock is then put in a situation where, as counsel to Mr. Lubbock, and as Mr. Haddon-Lubbock, he's put in a position where he has to assume that this is how the court came up with attributing between 5 to 15 kilograms of cocaine to him, which subjected him to a statutory minimum of 10 years as opposed to 5 years. In addition to that, Your Honors, the court also depended on the and I do believe that by not issuing the explicit reasons and the findings of fact, that was a clear error. And in addition to that, the court at sentencing transcript page number 25, the court actually stated that the court would more specifically address Mr. Haddon-Lubbock's objections to the drug quantity in a separate sentencing memorandum that will be filed after the sentencing hearing, and no such memorandum was ever filed. So in addition to not giving an explicit explanation at the sentencing hearing and making a cryptic comment that says, okay, well, the findings of fact from bench trial addressed it, the court also stated that a sentencing memo would occur, what would be filed, that never was filed. But furthermore, regarding the amounts of drugs attributed to my client, the district court used the testimony of a Rodney Bew. And in that testimony, Mr. Bew never stated that how much money he made from all the transactions with my client. He never stated that he was a part of weighing or knew the exact weights of the drugs with my client. And he also made statements that in some situations he said that he didn't keep records, and in some situations he said he couldn't even remember exactly. And based on those facts as well, I believe that though Mr. Bew's testimony, which is the sole piece of evidence that was used to attribute the drug amounts to my client, was not accurate enough to attribute them to my client. And in order to also address my third issue, I would like to move on to the delegation argument and the brief. In the sentencing hearing, my client, the court issued a fine, or a fine was issued against my client. And the court, there was no schedule, repayment schedule that was sent, or there was no repayment schedule established at sentencing. And therefore, that is a violation of the...
So what's the harm?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the harm is actually the harm is the board of prisons at this point decides how much my client will have to pay, and he's actually at this point he's required to pay while he's in prison, which means that not only is it a harm to him, but it's actually a harm to his family, because his family has to come up with this money in order to pay.
The judge would set a different schedule?
Well, I do. Well, not only do I think the judge may set a different schedule, but the statement at sentencing, the judge specifically made it a part of the payment of his fine that he must have the fine repaid before his supervised release is terminated, which can be interpreted to mean that he doesn't have to start paying his fine until after he's released from prison, or that he's supposed to make minimum payments until release from prison and then pay a certain amount after that, but nonetheless to make sure it's paid before it's supervised release.
You know, you haven't mentioned anything about this ineffective assistance claim that you have. Are you withdrawing that?
No, Your Honor. I would prefer to rest on the brief regarding.
But you know you only have one opportunity to argue ineffective assistance. I just don't see how you could demonstrate ineffective assistance on the basis of this trial record without the lawyer saying why he advised a certain course of action.
Well, I see my time is up. If the court would please the court, I would answer the question.
Following the Judge Posner rule, you can answer that question.
In the ineffective assistance of a counsel situation, Your Honor, the prongs are a performance prong to show that the standards were unreasonable and then there was a harm. In this situation, whereas the record's not clear.
Well, you just answered the question. The record's not clear. So how can you possibly want to make an ineffective assistance argument on the basis of this record, because that's all you have to go on? I think you're better off withdrawing that and saving it for 2255 if you ever think that has any merit in and of itself. But it's up to you.
I would like to reserve that for the to see if it's possible.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Beals. Mr. Kubiatowski.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Kubiatowski, representing the United States. With respect to the sentencing challenge on the drug amounts, Judge Sykes, as he pointed out, the district court, this was a bench trial, and the district court, in making its findings regarding drug amounts, specifically referenced its extensive findings of fact and conclusions of law that it published in connection with its verdict. And in those findings, the district court specifically found Rodney Bue's testimony to be credible. And Rodney Bue testified that on three occasions he brokered transactions for the defendant, Hatton Louisville, for 1 kilogram of cocaine. The district court specifically referenced two of those transactions in her amended findings. She also agreed with the government that during the course of the conspiracy, 12 transactions were brokered by Mr. Bue through various suppliers, including Mr. Perez, for Mr. Hatton Lubick. In simple math terms, if you have at least three transactions with 1 kilogram of cocaine, and the other nine transactions at a minimum were in the amount of 0.25 kilogram of cocaine, you have at least 5.25 kilograms of cocaine. That would be more than sufficient to justify the finding of 5 to 15 kilograms of cocaine in this case. With respect to ineffective assistance of counsel, I'm not sure whether or not the defendant did in fact withdraw his argument. We would ask that you decide this case on the merits. The court has been very clear in its case law regarding admonishing defendants for bringing these type of arguments on appeal when the record is not fully developed, and there should be some consequence to that if the defendant persists in bringing these type of arguments when the record is not fully developed. Unless there are any further questions regarding any of the other issues.
Yeah, a response to the point about the payment schedule. Now, you said in the brief, you seem to say in the brief that there, apart from the plain error business, that there was no error at all because the judge said 10% of net income, and then the probation office set, you know, 10% a month. Is that correct?
I think the brief says that, Your Honor. I think to be more precise, there was error. Our argument is that it's not reversible plain error.
What was the error?
The error is that a fine payment schedule wasn't set during the course of the period of incarceration.
Was it made payable immediately? Was the fine made payable immediately?
No, it wasn't. The fine, based on the district court's clarification in the J&C, was that it would be made over the course of the period of supervised release at a period of 10%.
What did you mean by 10%? You think his 10% was during the period of release?
During the period of release, Your Honor.
You know, when there's no objection to these kind of things at sentencing, why isn't the best procedure to do what we've recently done in these drug testing cases and say it's no plain error? There's no plain error.
Well, that's what the government exactly is arguing, Your Honor.
Restitution orders, it's such an easy thing to correct in the district court if there is a problem or to raise it as an issue in front of the district judge and the district judge can consider. Plus, you can always go back to the district court for clarification or modification of any of these sorts of things.
And that's why we're
drug testing, restitution, the amount of the fine, payments getting involved.
That's why we're asking the court to consider Tejada in the context of...
It does make a difference to him whether he has to pay while he's in prison or afterwards. Anyone would rather pay afterwards, right? Time value of money. Does he have to pay this $5,000 with interest?
That's not clear in the order either, Your Honor. Certainly, it does make it...
Not clear.
I don't think interest is clear.
Is interest charged on fines?
Sometimes it's waived, Your Honor. Sometimes it's not.
Well, that's not very helpful. Is this guy going to have to pay interest on the $5,000 fine?
No, not based on the judgment and commitment order. No, Your Honor.
So it makes a difference to him whether he doesn't have... How long is his sentence?
His sentence was the mandatory minimum, Your Honor, 120 months.
Pardon?
120 months.
Ten years. Well, you know, the present value of $5,000 after 10 years is small. Right? Whereas if he has to pay 10% of his net income while he's in prison, isn't that what the Bureau of Prisons says?
Yes.
Well, then he might pay the whole, it's improbable, obviously, pay it the whole first month, right? So that's a considerable difference.
We'd agree.
10 years, or starting to pay it 10 years from now and paying it now. Isn't that a big difference?
I don't believe that the interest, I don't think they can assert that there is any interest on the fine at this point, Your Honor, if it's not clarified.
No, look, the time value of money, $5,000 to be paid 10 years from now is not the same as $5,000 paid today. You'd much rather pay it 10 years from now than today, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. So it works a benefit to the defendant in this instance because he doesn't have to...
What? You got completely backwards.
I'm not following, Your Honor.
The Bureau of Prisons is making him pay while he's in prison, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's a big difference between his having to pay now and having to pay in 10 years, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it makes a difference to him, which it is.
But again, he has redress to the Bureau of Prisons to challenge it if he does believe it's
onerous. On what basis?
There is a statutory provision that I believe we cited, Your Honor, that allows him to challenge that particular assessment. If it's too onerous. That it's too onerous.
Well, why is it? No. Look, it's not necessarily onerous. Suppose he has $5,000 in his pocket. But the judge apparently thought it would be fine if he paid after he was released. Bureau of Prison says, no, we want your $5,000 now. Well, that makes a big difference to him. Whether he has to pay his money, maybe this is entire income, or not his entire, 10%. He has to, whether he pays it now or pays it in 10 years, right?
First of all, I believe for him to be subject to that interest, he has to be...
What are your interests? We're not talking about interest. Why do you keep bringing up interest?
He has to participate in the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program before the BOP can make him pay a fine during the course of his incarceration. That's my understanding. That's a voluntary decision. He does not have to join the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program. So on that basis, we don't think he can necessarily establish the prejudice point.
Would there be any advantage to him of joining?
My understanding are that there is certain privileges.
Yes, precisely.
Right. But it is his decision.
It's really bad. So what you're saying is if he gives up privileges, he doesn't have to pay the fine now. So he either pays the fine now or he gives up privileges. Whereas the judge seemed to think that paying a fine after he's released would be the appropriate mode of payment. So the Bureau of Prisons is, you know, trying to get more than the judge than the judge ordered. So I don't know why it's harmless.
Again, Your Honor, it's a question of whether or not he wants to join the inmate financial responsibility.
You keep missing the point. You just said there are privileges that attach to joining this inmate financial program. Now, if he gives up those privileges, that's a cost to him, right?
Right.
Just like paying $5,000 tomorrow is a cost. Whereas the judge seemed to think he could be in this financial program, he could have all the privileges, and he could defer paying the fine for 10 years, which would be a big advantage to him.
Well, wait, it's my understanding that the judge just said there's a fine of $5,000.
That was my understanding as well.
He didn't say, did he say, you don't have to pay anything on this while you're working in the prison?
I'm sorry? She didn't make any clarification on that point.
It was just a lot of fines in these criminal cases are sort of throwaway things at the end.
Well, the large
sense of 10 years in prison,
right?
Fine of $5,000 and 3 years supervised release.
It was at
never an objection to it by anyone.
Well, the judge said if your fine is not paid by the time you're released from incarceration, the payment of that fine will be a condition of your supervised release.
That implies the judge contemplated payments during incarceration.
Yes, it would, Your Honor.
But didn't say how much.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's the violation that we're talking about here.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And I understood there was also a prompt of some sort from the probation officer in court.
Right. That's correct, Your Honor.
To get the 10% of income during the term of supervised release stated on the record?
That's correct, Your Honor.
How do we know whether that applies to during the prison or after during supervised release?
Only referring to the judgment and commitment order, Your Honor. I think we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the defendant in that case that it only applies to the period of supervised release. I don't see anything that would suggest in the record that the judge intended that it be part of the period of incarceration.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And Mr. Beals, does he have any time left? We'll give you a minute if you have something urgent you'd like to tell us.
You better say definitively whether you're withdrawing the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Well, Your Honors, since I have not had an opportunity to speak to my client regarding that matter, I have no other choice but to continue on with the ineffective assistance of counsel on the record. Now, regarding just two quick things. Regarding the argument that the government made, the findings of fact argument, the district court did find that Rodney Bue's testimony was credible. The issue was whether or not Rodney Bue was telling the truth. The issue was not whether or not Rodney Bue was accurate in the truth that he was telling. In addition to that, the government is very clear about how they calculate the drug amounts, the drug range, between 5 to 15 kilograms of cocaine. It's quite clear. If the district court would have been as clear as the government was in their calculations, that it may very well have been a different story. However, the district court never gave a clear assessment of how they calculated those drugs. The government said that if you take three transactions at a kilogram apiece and then you take the remaining transactions, and even at a quarter kilogram, then that shows 5 kilograms. Well, in this situation, that's not what the district court did in the findings of fact from the after the bench trial, nor at sentencing, nor after sentencing. And finally, Your Honors, regarding the delegation argument, there there are disadvantages for my client while he's currently in prison, that if he does not make payments, because his payments on his fine, because payments are taken off of his books. Money that's put on his books by his family also is used for other items like purchasing personal hygiene items and so forth. So if the money that's on his books, the fine amount, a certain amount is taken out that is determined by the prisons at this point first before he's able to use the money on his books. Therefore, he faces a situation where he may not have any money on the books where he can use to get personal items.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gales. And court will be in recess until 9:30.